Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views and the views of our guest. And this evening, what we're going to have with us, Joel Skousen from World Affairs Brief. Joel, thank you so very much for being with us again.
Thank you. It's my pleasure, Dr. Stan.
Well, why don't you bring us up to date on what's going on in the world? Certainly, it looks like things are going to be a little different in Washington after the lame duck is over, its session is over, and January of next year, why the Democrats take over control of the House and have Senate. But is there going to be a lot of difference as far as our society is concerned, or is this a lot of window dressing?
Well, it is a lot of window dressing, and it's going to be very interesting window dressing. They are going to mix things up and make the appearance of things very, very different, but the same old warmongering intervention within the world is going to continue. And, you know, I've been covering uncovered this week through my researchers some very interesting analysis. I'm not the only one who believes that the Republicans purposely threw the election in order to get Team B elected. It wasn't necessarily the Republicans threw it, but the powers to be that controlled both parties through the election. And Will Bunch of the Philadelphia Daily News put out a huge conspiracy theory claiming just that, flat out, that Karl Rove and the Republicans threw the election. And he listed a bevy of evidence, which just seems to be overwhelming. So I want to go through that a little bit. You know, we can ask the question, you know, why didn't they remove, I mean, if they were planning on removing Rumsfeld anyway, which they were, obviously, because they had already picked Gates, they had already interviewed him the Sunday before, so it wasn't because of the election that he was gone. They simply delayed doing it until it was too late to help the Republicans in the election.
What you're basically saying is getting rid of Rumsfeld would have helped them, certainly would have taken away one of the big reasons people were voting against the Bush administration.
Exactly. And just as bad, you know, why get the president to endorse Rumsfeld on the eve of the election? A move certainly, you know, to cost his party many seats in the House. Why did he allow Cheney on the eve of the election to say that it was not only stay the course of Iraq, but it was full speed ahead? I mean, it was purposely inflammatory. Why was there no true October or November surprise this time around? Now, for your audience, what that means in political science terms is you pull out a major international crisis to engender patriotic fervor right before an election so that you have something to say, well, we've got to stay the course. There was no major terrorist attack. There was no major thing to whip up the fervor of Americans. Only just continued bad news. You know, given Bush's unpopularity, why was he sent to campaign in places where he did more harm than good? Why did the White House suddenly make the president more visible by having more press conferences and letting him speak off the cuff without a prepared text? I've talked about that several months ago, that in the summertime when he started doing that. And so obviously there was a concerted effort to make him look like the bumbling person that he is in front of a camera without a prepared text. You know, we can also ask, why did incumbents Conrad Burns and Montana and George Allen of Virginia fail to ask for recounts when they lost very, very narrow races, throwing the Senate to the Democrats without a whimper? Why... Or do we have a break up?
Yes, we do over here. We've got about 40 seconds, so our guest this evening is Joel Skousen, World Affairs Brief, and when we get back here, of course, we're going to continue going over all the things that make it look like the people who control both political parties were ready to let us throw the scoundrels out, but nothing's going to change. Go right ahead, Joel.
You know, one of the most interesting aspects of this election is that in contrast to the prior two elections, where there was a considerable mismatch between the polling data, or that is, the exit polls, and the actual numbers for the election, this time they matched nearly exactly, all across the board. And what that tells me is, and I think there's a couple of reasons for that, that tells me that they did no electronic manipulation of the vote, even though they could have. There's two reasons for that. One, I think they didn't need to. They were getting the results that they wanted. They did not this time want to throw the results in favor of Republicans, which lost, frankly, the past two elections in the sense of they had to be manipulated. But this time, I think there's so much heat going towards Diebold and the two other electioneering machinery companies over vote fraud that they wanted to have just a pure election with no fraud whatsoever to kind of kill that. Do you get my drift, what I'm trying
sure
to say?
I sure do, right. Uh-huh. In other words, we will accept the fact that these are honest, we're going to get a good vote, and then what is really important, why, of course, they'll fix the elections again.
That's right. So, but now this whole thing will be disarmed. They're able to disarm the vote fraud thing because everything went perfectly, and everybody now has confidence in the electronic voting machines. Oh, there were a few glitches, but they were probably honest glitches. You know, we can also ask, why did Karl Rove toss resources into hopeless Senate races in blue states such as New Jersey and Pennsylvania while allowing Montana and Virginia to slip away? Why did Bush's Justice Department go after Representative Kurt Weldon in the final weeks? How is it that a Republican source first leaked the Mark Foley scandal? It wasn't a Democratic source. It was a Republican source leaking this. The GOP lost both seats, of course. Why did so many conservative commentators, such as Joe Scarborough, say near the end of the election that Republicans deserve to lose power? And what happened to the Diebold, you know, as we said, vote counting fears? So maybe he's saying Karl Rove did fix the election, but in the Democrats' direction. Now, there's a very interesting counterpoint of view to this that appears to be at least a counterpoint of view, and it comes from Wayne Mattson, who comes from the left, and he is of the opinion that the Democrats threw the election as well. Now, this takes some analysis because the Democrats won, but it's very interesting to notice how they won. So let me see. You know, this mostly revolves around Representative Rahm Emanuel of Illinois, who withheld. He's the campaign committee chairman of the Democratic Congressional Committee.
Hold that thought right there, which is just a moment, please. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Joel was simply analyzing, really, of course, a lot of the unexplained things that happened, you know, in the election, and certainly, Republicans did not demand a recount in New Jersey and one other state where they might very well, with a recount, have gotten their man into the Senate. They just didn't bother to try, and that really isn't very logical. On the other hand, why, of course, now the Democrats will control the Senate. Why would the Republicans do everything they could possible to maintain the control of the Senate? And there were so many other things that they did that just didn't make sense. And, of course, as Joel pointed out, immediately before the election, they were letting President Bush get up and give all sorts of press conferences without a prepared speech and give talks without a prepared speech. And he really doesn't do very well if he doesn't have a prepared speech. And so it gave the average American the impression he was sort of a bumbling idiot. And then, of course, we have the issue of Rumsfeld. We have the issue that the president saying Rumsfeld's going to stay in, even though he had already decided to replace him. Bush is saying we're going to stay the course, everything's going fine, knowing full well that this was something people felt very badly about, and most people, or many, many people, wanted just to get out of Iraq and stop the carnage over there. So they made so many mistakes, and it's difficult to think that they could have done that unintentionally. But then Joel is speaking that there are some Democrats who have a different opinion, liberals. They think that the Democrats, rather than the Republicans, threw the election. So you pick that idea up.
Well, it's actually that both occurred. The Republicans were throwing the election, and the Democrats were attempting to make sure that they got a certain type of victory. And this takes some explanation and some specific examples. And I'm quoting here from Wayne Mattson, who's on the left himself. And he smells a rat as he looks at the specific candidates who got money from Representative Emanuel, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee chairman. He's the one who determines who gets the Democratic Party funds to boost their election chances during the election. So withholding of funds by Emanuel has been reported by Wayne Mattson through the auspices of the unsuccessful Democratic House candidates. They are livid with the Democratic National Committee because, and I'll go through some of the evidence. The Emanuel strategy apparently was at loggerheads with Democratic National Committee Chairman Howard Dean. The strategy was to fight a 50-state campaign against the GOP with support for all Democrats across the board. It's now clear that Dean's strategy was the correct one, says Wayne Mattson, and that Emanuel and his fellow Democratic Leadership Council people, who were anti-Dean partisans, people like James Carville, Simon Rosenberg, Joe Lieberman, and these people are basically neocons, aligned with the Republican, they're probably globalists is what I mean. In other words, they're part of the same, they want the same objectives as the liberal Republicans did in terms of changing over to Team B in Congress. And I'll get to those overall reasons why these manipulations were done. But he claims that the selective throwing of all the money to campaigns that we either clearly won or clearly were losing campaigns cost the Democrats an even wider margin of victory in the House and possibly the Senate. For example, take the Florida 15th Congressional District in which retired Air Force Colonel Bob Bowman ran against entrenched Republican Dave Weldon. Now, Bowman, who won an impressive 44% in a strong Republican district, did not receive 1 cent from the Democratic National Committee or from the Florida Democratic Party. Now think of that. Weldon raised $750,000 for his campaign while Bowman had a scant $91,000, and yet he got 44% of the vote with just a little bit more money from the Democratic National Committee. They could have had it. But Bowman was not on the, the globalist team. And this is what we'll find as we analyze these ones who were cut off funding, is that they were people who were not going to go along with the, I mean, they were hardline against Iraq. They wanted to get out of Iraq, and they wanted to impeach the president. They had a hardline agenda, and the Democratic leadership wanted this softline agenda to give some difference with the Republicans, but not to have any radical change. And this is why it's important for them not to have a lot of newcomers in there. That would force the leadership of the Democratic Party to change into a more radical mode when they want to follow the same globalists. I mean, they're going to protest, they're going to do some investigations, but essentially nothing's going to change in Iraq, as we'll find out later. Another candidate who was ignored by Emanuel and his committee was the Florida 24th District candidate, Clint Curtis. He's a former programmer who asked by his opponent, Tom Feeney, to write a program to flip votes on voting machines in Florida. So this is a real whistleblower who ran for Congress. Curtis beat the favored Democratic candidate, Andy Michaud, in the primary. Now, the Democratic Party didn't like this, so he was punished by Emanuel and his clique with absolutely no money. Now, this is the guy who blew the whistle on vote fraud in Florida, and yet apparently the Democratic leadership didn't want him in Congress. In other words, they didn't want somebody blowing the whistle on vote fraud because this is still something that they intend to use in the future. So Feeney had, you know, $1.2 million in his war chest, while Curtis had a mere $44,000. Yet Curtis almost fared as well as Bowman, got 42% and not one dime from the Democratic National Committee. So it's not just Florida, of course. In the California's 44th district, Democratic candidate Louis Vandenberg ran against the extremely corrupt Ken Calvert for the fourth time, was not able to advance beyond 38%. Even in what appears to be a Democratic-based area in East Los Angeles District. Now, the major reason, again, was no support from the Democratic or the state Democrats. Calvert raised, $863,000 for his campaign, while Vandenberg, who this year drew the largest crowds ever in his campaign, set a paltry $5,000 to run his campaign. So it's very interesting here that the Democrats were being just as selective as Republicans were in terms of not, and you even look at the Joe Lieberman race. I mean, Joe Lieberman retained his Senate seat because the powers that be got behind him and gave him a lot of funding. And he was able to out-campaign and out-spend his Democratic component who had beat him in the... you can see what I'm saying is the Democratic leadership did not want strong, active, anti-war people in their party. And that's why Nancy Pelosi keeps saying the line, there's not going to be an impeachment of the president. It's a dead end. They're going to go along to get along.
And of course, I think the Connecticut race was really, with Lieberman, was amazing because the Republican Party, instead of backing the Republican candidate, was backing Joe Lieberman. That was so incredible.
Yes.
Why would the Republicans be backing Joe Lieberman, who was a Democrat, and when he got back in, he would become part of the Democratic Senate majority? Doesn't make sense. I mean, you would think they would back the Republican instead of backing the Democrat, or maybe... maybe there's not a dime's worth of difference, and Lieberman would go, was the man that they wanted because he was pro-war.
Well, now let's talk about the reason, you know, why, on the one hand, the Republicans were throwing the election in order to let Team B, the Democrats, come in, and why the Democrats were making sure that there weren't any real strong anti-war people to get in. Now you say, well, they're advancing Representative John Murtha up to House Majority Whip, a majority leader under House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. And of course, even the left is very concerned about this because Murtha was caught in the FBI sting operation on corruption. They've got him on tape, not exactly accepting the money, but talking about how much was going to go into his bank account and what kind of deal that could be made, and he wasn't committing himself to it, but he's definitely talking turkey with these people, and the FBI's got it on tape. It's no wonder Murtha has not been an active participant in ethics reform in the House. This guy is as corrupt as Cunningham was in the Abraham scandal and Foley and all the rest. It's just simply a way of life within Congress. About 75% of Congress, I think, is strongly controlled by the fingers of power, the lobbyists, and the way in which the both parties can get large corporations who have insider connections with government to give contributions to both Democrats and Republicans in order to throw an election. But I think the real reason why they both went this direction is, first of all, Team B is going to get discredited. The Democrats aren't going to be able to fix any of the problems. What they will be able to do is get a lot of their social agenda passed. These are the same social agendas that the liberal Republican wing of the party wants to pass as well. Universal health insurance for people, an increase in the minimum wage, there'll be more education, there'll be more higher taxes. Nothing's much going to change in Iraq other than the fact that they're going to use a little more diplomacy, which I'll cover a very interesting interview by CFR head Richard Haass about the... this election and how the CFR is playing this thing. But I think what they really want, the Republicans obviously have set up George Bush to take the blame ultimately for the next war that is coming, which will be a retaliation for all of this intervention in the Middle East, which is going to continue, though, at a different pace. But what they want the Democrats in there for these next 2 years is so that they can share in the blame. So that it will no longer be, I mean, the international community obviously is going to still blame Bush. Bush has got the lack of intelligence, he's got the idiotic phraseology that makes him the laughing stock of the world as well as in the United States. But now the Democrats are going to get a bad name by entangling themselves in this quagmire and not extricating. So everybody's going to be equally blackened by the time the next election comes out. Because the establishment powers, I believe, want Rudolph Giuliani as the next president. He's just started his campaign committee. He beat John McCain to the punch. He's very serious, and so are the establishment powers serious about trying to get Giuliani in. We'll have to see some softening of his liberal pro-abortion and pro-homosexual inclinations, but I think that'll happen in the campaign.
Well, my concern is that people are just getting increasingly disillusioned with everything. And when you're disillusioned with both political parties, you have no alternative. then you become disillusioned with America. We'll be back in just a few minutes, and believe me, we shouldn't be. America's well worthwhile saving. We've just got to try. Go right ahead, Joel.
So, what I think is happening here is that the powers that be are setting it up for the Democrats to take a turn at governing. President Bush will play along with almost everything. I don't think he's going to use his veto an awful lot, although he should. But he'll play along, and when things go sour again, then the Democrats are going to get a good portion of the blame this time, and the country will be ready for a new slate. And everybody's talking about the fact that there are no vice presidential candidates running. Cheney, of course, is out of the question. He's very unpopular. So there's no there's no old line political candidate here. It's everybody new. And so this is going to be a fresh election. Everyone's going to give everyone a fresh start about this. And essentially they're setting up to balance the scales, I believe, before the 2008 election. It's very important. Secondarily, the powers that be want to pass many of the liberal agenda that only the Democrats can get through Congress, or at least can be caught spearheading these types of outright socialistic views. Now, the Republicans did their share of things, but they always couched them in conservative terms. Only the Republicans could have, which is Team A, only the Republicans could have got the country to go along with the loss of civil rights. Had the Democrats done that, all of the Republicans and independents would have been unified in attacking the Democrats as they attacked Clinton when he was in office. But when the Republicans did even worse in destroying our liberties, of course, most of the nation went along with it. So these are some fine-tuned adjustments that they're attempting to take care of prior to this next election. Meanwhile, things are going downhill very fast in the European Union. They're going down very fast in the Middle East. We're getting all kinds of cross signals about Iran and Iraq. But before I go to that, I have a small item that was sent to me by one of my subscribers in Denmark. And he had a very interesting view about the EU from the ordinary Danish people. Now, this is one of the smaller countries who hasn't joined the EU Monetary Union yet, and is resistant. Britain hasn't joined that monetary union as well, still has the pound. But this is a very interesting commentary, so let me quote from that. It says, most ordinary Danes don't really care about the EU. It's just a bureaucratic thing down in Europe. The high-profile politicians and leaders of big business in Denmark have tried for years to tell the Danes that we're living in a globalist world and we can't stand alone without the EU. But still, the common Danish people are not too friendly with the thought of a single currency, an EU army, and a common refugee policy. And, you know, this refugee policy, as well as the common border policy, means that not only can people go and live anywhere in Europe, because it's like going from state to state in the United States now. You don't have to have a passport. You've got an EU passport, and you can travel freely, and you can work, and you can take up residence. And, of course, the more stable northern Germanic countries in England are getting an influx of the southern people coming up, where they're looking for the higher-paying jobs, and they're bringing all the refugees with them. You have your Muslim refugees, your Turkey refugees, the people who aren't doing well. And, you know, you have a semi-welfare state there. And so that's what he's talking about the common refugee policy. But let me continue. He says, they don't understand why laws have to be changed after an order from the EU. And they're complaining about the EU demands that Denmark, you know, put
hold
there.
Hold that thought just for a moment. Okay. We'll be right back here in just a moment with our stations. Okay, well, this is Dr. Stan, and Joel is simply reading from a letter he'd gotten from one of his data subscribers talking about the European Union and the fact that a lot of the Europeans just don't like the idea that some centralized bureaucracy over which they have no control is passing laws that are suddenly being enforced on the Danish people. They don't like the migration policy by which all the people from Eastern Europe and many of the refugees from Muslim countries are flowing into their country, and of course they're a welfare state, so they've got to provide for them. Now that they have free movement, anybody can come to their country. They're beginning to lose total control of their boundaries and certainly control of the welfare system as well. So pick up the story, Joe.
You know, he says that they're also concerned. He says the new countries from the Eastern Europe have a long history of corruption, and they have taken that with them into the EU. And it's very true there. It's also true of Italy and Spain. Your southern countries, Bulgaria and Romania, they have a tendency to, have very corrupt mafia-type government with corrupt bureaucracies. The bureaucracies, on the other hand, in Germany, Luxembourg, Brussels, Denmark have a very pristine bureaucracy. They wouldn't dare take bribes. It's just unknown in those higher Eastern or Western European countries. And so they're bringing those habits with them. He says, we are also afraid that the laws and regulations would be forced to be the same in the whole EU. Well, he's right, they're right on about that fear. It's going to be through the Danish, high Danish standard and most likely the low Southern European standard. The high Danish standard is going to have to go in laws, and we're all going to get to the lowest common denominator in terms of environmental laws and regulations about food additives. They're very much aware in Denmark and other areas where they take a lot of pride in not using a lot of food additives that these new regulations are too tight from the EU and have no choice at all. Of course, the EU has bent to the Monsanto Corporation allowing genetic-modified food into Europe, which the individual countries with high environmental standards were not allowing. He says that elections in Denmark, the attendance is 80% to 90% range. Now, that's for local elections. But in elections for the EU Parliament, the attendance is down to 60%. So he says most Danes don't care about the U.S. Some of us are scared of us, and sadly, the same number as us loves it intensely. So it's that's why Denmark has not joined the currency union. They still have the kroner, and in any case, it's going to be interesting how they finally seduce those nations to have full membership in the EU. And it will most likely be through a crisis, and if not that, certainly the crisis of war will bring it in. Let's see, moving to, let me think here.
You were going to talk about Iran and Iraq next, I think.
Right. Let me just cover a related issue, too. The news.com brought out an issue that the Bajur attack on this Muslim school, fundamentalist school, evidence from Washington or from Pakistan indicates that Pakistan authorities have admitted they had little choice to bomb the Bajur school site after they'd received overwhelming, quote, proof from U.S. intelligence sources that it was being used as a training center for insurgents. Pakistanis said they loaded us with evidence. The strike was absolutely inevitable, said a senior intelligence official. Another official called the attack a major test of military and intelligence cooperation in the United States and Pakistan. We thought about other options, but the Americans wouldn't hear of it. We were caught between the devil and the deep blue sea, he said. A refusal to act would have badly damaged their relation with the United States. What he's trying to say is that that's code for we were threatened by the U.S. You attacked that school, or we'll cut off aid and various other things. So apparently the U.S. has a great deal of arm-twisting power over Pakistan. And then they found out, of course, after they bombed it, that in fact it wasn't a training school. All of the evidence indicates this was once again trumped up by the U.S., forced upon the Pakistanis. And what's worse now, what this does to Pakistan is cause them to have an inflamed problem with their Muslim fundamentalist against Musharraf and his government. So they are between a tough place and a hard spot.
And of course, what we're doing, I believe, is doing everything possible to inflame the fundamentalist Islamic people against the United States. In other words, you can't get a war going unless you've got hatred. We've got to hate them, they've got to hate us. And I'm sure that that bombing, if this was not a terrorist training school, that bombing, of course, infuriated the people of Pakistan, but primarily the radicals there who already dislike the United States and I feel that they probably dislike us a lot more right now. We're going to be back here in just a moment with Joel Scalise as we begin exploring what's really going on in the world. Well, Dr. Stan, I guess Joel Scalise. Joel, go ahead, pick up the story there.
Well, let's move on to the Middle East now. It's really interesting what's been happening here. In the week prior to Prime Minister Ehud Olmert coming to the United States to talk to President Bush here this week, he really hyped up the fact that he says the only situation in which Iran will agree to compromise on the continuation of its nuclear program is if it sees genuine reasons to fear reprisals, said the Prime Minister. He told Newsweek that. Iran must start to fear, Olmert declared, stressing that Israel would favor a compromise that would prevent Iran from achieving nuclear capacity. But are you all still there, Dr. Stan?
Yes, we are listening. Go right ahead.
Okay, I was just having some sounds on my cell phone here. But in any case, this is the first time in many years that the official leader of a major nation with more than 7 million citizens has talked of the liquidation of another nation. That's what Olmert talking about, President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad threatening war crimes against Israel with the loss of existence. So this was a very bellicose statement by Olmert, threatening without saying it exactly. He used the old option statement. Israel has many options to stop Iran from its nuclear activity, and that's a hint that they may be using military power. Now, when he comes to the United States, he has a totally different tack. He's now saying, of course, that they're only going to use diplomacy. This seems to be very much aligned with the U.S. election result. The big name is diplomacy, even with Iran and in Syria. And as one pundit said on the Jim Lehrer show on public television, he says, well, I don't really understand what the United States is intending to talk with Syria about. I mean, what common ground, what do they have to offer Syria that it's such a belligerent situation with the support for Hezbollah that Syria has done in Lebanon. And it's a very good point. I mean, you know, you could talk diplomacy, but when they get down to say, well, what are you going to talk about? It's as Richard Haass said to his in his interview with Der Spiegel, he said, well, he was being very sly and slick about this because, as you know, the CFR is really calling the shots. They are the globalists that are controlling both parties. And so, you know, it's very interesting because it's a very necessary foreground to set the stage for more dramatic action in the world by pursuing diplomacy for all that you're worth. What he was really saying here, this is the excuse for war. In other words, we have to go and play like we're talking, and we'll set up impossible conditions so that the talks will fail, and then we can
hold
go...
That, hold that thought right there. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Joel Scalise. And before we go on, Joel is talking about what's going on in the Middle East as far as Israel, as far as Iraq, as far as Iran is concerned. And then, of course, was beginning to talk a little bit about some of the things that Richard Haass, and Richard Haass is one of the key players. He is currently the president of the Council on Foreign Relations, one of the 130 members of the North American Group of the Trilateral Commission. But before we go on with that tact, Joel, I'd like you to tell our listeners how they can get the World Affairs Brief and perhaps even a trial copy if they'd like to.
Yes, my labor of love is the World Affairs Brief. It's my weekly analysis of the news where I talk in even greater detail than what we do on these interviews about the top news stories each week and how I see behind the scenes and what the real machinations of our leaders are and leaders around the world. Listeners can go to my website, worldaffairsbrief.com. That's www.worldaffairsbrief.com. And check out all of the daily news stories. We scroll down the screen all day long. These are pre-screened by my researchers so that you get the best stories. And then of those stories, I analyze, like we're doing today, what's going on and the difference between what they say publicly and what they mean. Help people interpret events in the world. There is a modest subscription for my weekly subscription, for my weekly newsletter. Your listeners can get a free sample copy or two of the World Affairs Brief by emailing me at editor@worldaffairsbrief.com. That's editor@worldaffairsbrief.com, and I'll be happy to send it out to you. I think you'll enjoy it.
And I will second that. I look forward to getting it every week. So let's pick up, go back to the story you were talking about. And you were talking about Richard Haass, who is one of the key players behind everything going on today. So basically, what was the point you were making?
Well, in his interview with Der Spiegel, where he was commenting on the election, he made a couple of interesting points. And, of course, he talked about the need for change, the Bush policy. He plays like he's a critic, and they publish in Foreign Affairs, the Journal of the Council on Foreign Relations, some critical information. It's always to kind of twist and turn the remarks to set up the next agenda in the future. You'll find themselves turning on Bush when Bush is ready to be thrown to the dogs and become the laughingstock of the world, when they will blame the next war on Bush. I'm convinced poor old George Bush doesn't realize he's been set up to become the image, the icon of the worst president that's ever been at the head of the nation. He thinks, you know, that he's been called because of certain other reasons, and he feels that he's successful in that, but he's going to turn out to be completely discredited. And these people who are controlling him, who are giving him the direction, are the ones who will recover and put into place other people to take her place to become the hero. This is Hegelian tactics, where you create conflict, you create incompetence, you create a situation in order to provide the motive and the the motivation for change. And Haass said that as much. He said, you know, when he was speaking, Der Spiegel was asking about the difficulty the president will have with the Democratic leadership in Congress now controlling the agenda. And it really is. If you look at the procedural powers that the party in power has over the party out of power, it's tremendous what they can do to control the committees, to control investigation, to control how bills are amended, whether they're amendments, whether or not it gets passed onto the floor. There's a tremendous amount of power that the Democrats will now be able to wield. And Haass said this in response to these types of comments, but you must remember that out of conflict comes great opportunities to change the world. So he was basically talking about the Pearl Harbor mention in the PNAC report, which was essentially, we need new Pearl Harbors in order to engender change within the world.
And of course, that's a standard technique. You have a crisis, and then, of course, you can get change. And I believe, of course, the 9-1-1 attack was exactly what was planned, and I believe it was the crisis that was to change the direction of America and make us willing to accept increased government surveillance and make us willing to accept these draconian laws which allow the president to declare a dictatorship in case there's a disaster or an epidemic or civil unrest. What, I cannot imagine the American people are not up in arms over the Military Commission Act, over the John Warner National, Act, you know, this whole idea that this Defense Authorization Act, which allows them, the president, to use the U.S. military, at least the National Guard, against American personnel. This has never been allowed before.
Well, even, you know, our socialist Senator Patrick Leahy, who's no friend of liberty, is, called the president on the carpet on that thing and decried it on the Senate floor. This is a major change in U.S. policy towards the relationship between citizens and using the military at will and putting the military under complete control of the president. And it's very, very ironic now, you know, that we have the Democrats actually championing causes which conservatives should have been. But in terms of foreign policy, conservatives have been totally co-opted by this administration, not by Bush himself, who's simply the script reader, but by certainly the very, very strong elements of control that he gets from National Security Council people and Vice President Cheney. But, you know, going back to the Middle East, it's very interesting how the Israeli government mirrors the kind of false conservatism that our own Republican administration has done for us here in this country. Prime Minister Olmert is just creating havoc with the right wing in Israel because he's taking on all the liberal causes. And, of course, he is endorsing now this unity government in the Palestinian or Gaza city. But it's not all that, you know, they keep trying to have a unity government, which means that the opposing parties of Fatah and Hamas are supposed to join forces in order to pick a new prime minister. They picked an independent academic from the University, Mohammed Shabir, a clinical biologist, very, non-controversial person to head the Islamic University of Gaza. And this is supposed to be the new prime minister, but obviously he's going to be a puppet. I mean, all of the people are learning how to run these puppets. Their goal, of course, is to end the crippling Western freeze on aid to the Palestinian Authority, which is now just literally bankrupt. Not only to pay all of their welfare-type employees, almost 60% of everybody in Gaza works for the Palestinian Authority, and there's just no money to pay them all, except for, of course, the higher-ups. They still live in luxury. But in any case, nothing's really going to change here. Hamas backs the proposal for peace talks with Israel. At least they propose to at least talk peace with Israel. But Hamas says the new government won't recognize Israel's Israel, according to their spokesman, even though they're joining a unity government where Abbas, Mahmoud Abbas, continues to claim that Hamas is coming on board and that will recognize the two-state solution. But, of course, Hamas, through its other mouthpieces, always said that their position remains unchanged, that they won't join a unity government that recognizes Israel. So Mahmoud Abbas and his aides say the president will insist on a two-state solution, and then once again we're going to be at loggerheads. But here's a quote from Al-Azhar, which is one of the chief leaders of Hamas and Gaza. He says, we'll never recognize Israel. And he was speaking to Al-Shark Al-Wasat, the Palestinian foreign minister. And he says, Hamas will never agree to UN resolutions calling for a two-state solution. So, on one hand, you have for the press, when they're speaking English, they say that we're going to do something. And then when they're speaking in Arabic to the other Arabic press, it changes. The bigger picture, though, is that we have three major factions occurring in the Middle East. We have one going on in Gaza with Israel, with the, Gaza between Fatah and Hamas. And in Lebanon, things are falling apart, too, because the government of Prime Minister Signoria is on the rocks now that two major factions in the cabinet, Hezbollah, has pulled out, and one of the parties that had two seats has pulled out as well. And so now this means that the Signoria government essentially will have to be reformed. Hopefully, of course, what they're trying to get is a pro-Syrian government back in Lebanon. And they may well do it, although the U.S. is working hard to stop that from happening.
Well, I think people should understand that when the Syrians were there, certainly Hezbollah was nowhere near as powerful as they are today. It's when the Syrians pulled out that Hezbollah really sort of took over Lebanon. Is that right?
Well, I actually think that Hezbollah had just as much power before, but they didn't need to use it. They didn't need to come forward. They could keep underground, keep it hidden, as long as Syria was the big 800-pound gorilla lording over Lebanon. When they left, of course, Hezbollah had to begin to exercise its leadership. And, of course, it was preparing all that time that Syria was covering for Hezbollah preparations. And the preparations were dramatic and extensive, so much so that for the first time in history, the Israeli army could not beat a very active, outright military attack as well as an insurgency. And, of course, this has not been lost on the other people in the Middle East. They're all enthused about learning the techniques of Hezbollah, of creating both Iraq and Lebanon have told the rest of the people, forget about frontal attacks on Israel with tanks and missiles. Go for the guerrilla movement, and that's how to undermine that kind of a country. So, and the other, weak spot in the Middle East now is Iraq itself. Maliki, the prime minister, is just up to his eyeballs in problems. It probably may not last another month or so. The problem with it is that he's now reforming his cabinet. Essentially, the issue that he's getting lots of pressure from the United States is to disband these militias. But he showed during the time that the U.S. troops went into Muqtada al-Sadr's ghetto stronghold in Baghdad that he had no intentions of backing it up. He made disclaimers, as we talked about on your show before, of that this was not done with our approval, that I do not propose U.S. troops going in there. And so no one really believed al-Maliki was going to be serious about disbanding militias. And there's several members of his cabinet and his ministry, especially the security minister, who was a Sunni who was put in, who's been very much fomenting his own brand of infiltration to police forces, and there's been counter forces within the Shiite militias. There's a little civil war going on over there now. There was a major kidnapping today of an entire government office. Some 40 government employees were kidnapped and now will be either executed or held for ransom. People in police uniforms came in to get access to the building and to do the kidnapping. Nobody knows who belongs to who anymore. It is a crisis that is unraveling very, very fast. And I think the U.S. doesn't mind it unraveling at this time, because by the time the Democrats get in power, it's going to be in their shoes to try to fix it. It's not going to be fixed. So things look very, very bad.
An article in the paper today was just saying that there's just so many dead bodies in Baghdad that the mortuaries can't handle them, and there's just no way to identify them. They just don't have the places to bury them. Apparently, the whole system is just breaking down.
That's right, Dr. Stan, and it does look like the true number of Iraqi dead is in excess of 500,000. People since this war began. That's over half a million people.
And of course, that isn't necessarily they've all been killed by Americans at all. They've been killed as part of this fighting between the Shias and the Sunnis, which of course was released once, of course, with top of the existing government, and then destroyed the whole infrastructure of the nation. And we did that intentionally. That wasn't accidental.
You know, with all of these activities keeping our attention, we fail to understand that Russia is still preparing for nuclear war against the United States. It's interesting that this week we had another very underreported statement by Moscow through the Associated Press, where the Russian missile forces chief said that the military decided to keep its heaviest intercontinental ballistic missiles in service for another decade. So, the decision to extend the service lifetime of the RS-20B missiles, these are also the SS-18 Satan missile, which is known in the West, big liquid-fueled rocket, that we have been dismantling at taxpayer expense, giving them back the warheads. And they had agreed, Bush had agreed with Putin, that he was going to dismantle the rest of them 3 years ago, and then he stated that he wasn't going to do it, he was going to keep them. And they made the same announcement again. This is what's very strange. Why make the same announcement that was done 3 years ago? We've already known, I already reported on it in the World Affairs Brief, that the Russians were not going to dismantle any more of the SS-18s. That announcement was made even before the U.S. dismantled the MX missiles. And the U.S. continued their dismantling, even though the Russians broke their word on the treaty that authorized that mutual dismantling of missiles.
And I think what you're basically saying is the United States is unilaterally disarming in the face of one of the very, very large military buildup by the Russians, and it just doesn't make any sense.
That's right. Nothing is as it seems, as I know you are favored to saying. The Democratic victory, part of the big agenda that's going to get boosted, and one of the reasons why the Republican establishment wanted the Democrats to win, is that Bush now can get his immigration amnesty program through. So that's the silver lining from President Bush, and that's why he's so happy about working with them. A 700-mile border fence was pushed by the Republican Congress is now going to come under new scrutiny. There's no money that's been authorized for it, and the Democratic leaders have opposed the measures and may hold up funds for the project, which would please President Bush no end. And also, it's telling that President Bush gave Mexican President-elect Felipe Calderon an assurance in the Oval Office this week that he would push for broad immigration reform, including a new guest worker program, citizenship rights for illegal aliens. He assured the president-elect, said Mr. Bush, he says that we're very open to all arguments that I presented him on immigration. Of course, he was open to his arguments. He said, and he assured him that the fence would not be a problem. So there's a lot of a wink and a nod going on between Bush and Calderon, who is a globalist, an extension of Presidente Fox.
And of course, it's really all about this whole idea of uniting the United States and Mexico and Canada, but mainly United States and Mexico. And they can't tell the American people that that's the real plan. That's the reason that the president is pushing for amnesty. He says, well, I'm not in favor of amnesty. I just want them all to be able to stay here and become citizens eventually. But the whole idea is the destruction and the end of the national sovereignty of the United States. And most Americans have absolutely no idea what's really going on behind the scenes today. We're going to be back in just a moment to wrap up this evening's program here at Radio Liberty. Well, Joe, you have 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
Well, it's interesting that Calderon told the Spanish language press, once again, there's one thing that he says in English and another thing he tells the... didn't even mention the fence in the English press banter between Bush and Calderon. But then to the Spanish language press, Calderon said, I told him our opinion was that the wall is a mistaken remedy because it doesn't resolve the problem. He said he and other Mexican officials have compared the fence, which will be built on major smuggling corridors, to the Berlin Wall. You know, this is incredible how anyone could be so stupid to compare the fence to keep people from getting into a country to the Berlin Wall, which was put up to keep people from getting out of the country. Totally different procedures whatsoever.
And in fact, it's very interesting that Gorbachev said exactly the same thing. We should not build a fence like the Berlin Wall. He knows very well the Berlin Wall was to keep the Russians from getting out, not to keep the people in West Germany from getting in. But of course, Gorbachev is an internationalist. He's part of this whole program to destroy national sovereignty, just like the leaders of both of the political parties here in the United States.
Yes, Calderon said, of course, we want to foster trade relationships, our economic relationship even more. He said, we both understand that the only solution to the many problems that we have is to create well-paid jobs in Mexico. And frankly, it's never going to happen with the way that the U.S. economy continues to boom through the inflation of our monetary supply. And that means that basically they create money and credit to hand out many, many millions to these contractors coming back from Iraq who spend it in the United States. Still, he continues to claim, you know, that there are not enough jobs that want to be filled by Americans within this country, and that employers desperately need the Mexican laborers. Now, you know, part of that reason is because the Mexican labor is cheaper, especially the illegal market. I don't really even think that the Bush administration wants to end the illegal immigration, because illegal immigration maintains a steady flow of workers who, because of their illegal status, will work for peanuts, will work for very many small wages. I have a friend, a subscriber, who works for the Immigration Service, and I'll tell you, he says it's very, very clear that this administration does not want to penalize employers. They had a couple high-profile cases at the beginning, before the election. But it says, whenever we go after employers, we get calls from higher up in Washington say, lay off.
Hey, we're out of time, Joe, but thanks very much for being with us. We'll look forward to having you on the program a little later.
My pleasure, Doctor.
Good night. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course, we could go for a couple of hours with Joel Skousen, but unfortunately, why, the time will not allow us. I hope you enjoyed the program. And of course, what we're trying to point out is the real thrust behind everything going on today, as far as immigration is concerned, is President Bush and the leaders of both political parties want, of course, to open our borders, to encourage migration, because the real goal is to actually unite the United States and Mexico, actually to unite our law enforcement, unite our economies, unite our borders, so we'll just be guarding the southern Mexican border and the northern Canadian border, and we won't have to worry anything about the border between ourselves and Mexico or ourselves and Canada, because we're all going to be one big happy family. This is part of a long-range plan of uniting North America. Hugo Chavez is doing his job in South America, playing his part very well. The leaders of 25 African countries are meeting to set up a free trade zone in Africa. The leaders of the ASEAN nations under the sponsorship of Communist China, who we're doing everything we can to build up there, planning on having a trade block there. Of course, the European Union is in place. The whole idea is to have trade blocks, free trade blocks throughout the world, do away with national sovereignty, and then unite all the nations into the new order of the ages. That Novo Ordo Seclorum you see described on the back of the dollar bill, below the occult pyramid kept by the all-seeing eye of the great architect of the universe. And if you really don't understand what we're talking about, you need to get our pamphlets on the occult hierarchy. We have a a pamphlet set on the occult hierarchy. Or go to our website at RadioLiberty.com and read our August and September newsletters to understand who really rules the world. If you haven't read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, you need to get it. You need to get, of course, into the background of a symbol on the back of the dollar bill, the Great Seal. We have books on that. We have Dr. Kathy Bird's book on Masonic and occult symbols. That's Masonic and occult symbols. And, of course, they hide their symbols everywhere. Who are they? Why, they are the people who are part of the cult and secret societies that are in touch with the other dimension. And there really is another dimension. There really are spiritual forces that are moving to plunge America into another great world war. And then, of course, to use the horror that will follow that to bring about the one world government and the new world religion, which will mean the destruction of Christianity. For indeed, we're involved in a spiritual battle being fought on a political and ideological and cultural battlefield. Well, ladies and gentlemen, let me suggest a couple of things we can do. One of the things is we're trying to get Dr. Dennis Cuddy's book, Secret Records Revealed, reprinted. And if you'd be interested in taking a case of those books at pre-publication price, why, if you can get that, just give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like to get a very economical case of Dr. Dennis Cuddy's excellent book, Secret Records Revealed, which now has an index in it, which now has an epilogue, and it's one of the best tools you'll have to reach people to explain what is really going on. Then, of course, my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, we recommend still. You get the DVD or the video that goes with it. Just got a call from a ministry today that told me they received 12 copies of our DVD yesterday. They were all gone. They wanted 12 more today. And that's Brotherhood of Darkness. We hope that you'll get it. You'll watch it. It's a primer. It's an introduction to this other world. Certainly one of the books that's moving very well for us is Malachi Martin's Hostage to the Devil, and you can get it by itself or with our four-tape set by interviews with Malachi Martin, The Wisdom of Malachi Martin. We call it the Malachi Martin Special, Hostage to the Devil, and, of course, The Wisdom of Malachi Martin. We hope many of you, of course, will go to our website of RadioLiberty.com. Remember, you can listen to us 5 hours a day on the Internet, 9 hours a day out by satellite. You won't get much accomplished, but you'll have an awful lot of information. But we really want you, of course, out there informing others, learning what's going on. And then, of course, get the DVDs on what happened on 9/11, Terror Storm, 911, Press for the Truth, and the others that we carry. Pray for America. Pray for Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views and the views of our guest. And tonight our guest is John Spring. And John is a geographer. He's had his own radio program in Southern California, and we hope very soon he's going to be on there again. And we always enjoy having John with us. He has a very accurate analysis of so much of what's going on. So without further ado, John Spring, thank you for being our guest tonight.
Well, Dr. Stan, it's always a pleasure, and you have such a wonderful, informative program. And yes, I do hope to return to the airwaves very soon so that I can have you as a guest on my program.
Well, we'll look forward to it, John, anyway. So what would you like to talk about tonight?
Well, I thought I would just talk a few moments briefly about myself and my background and what is a geographer. Because here in the United States, since the Carnegie Endowment for Peace and the Carnegie Foundation early during the last century did everything they possibly could to curtail the teaching of serious geography, foreign affairs, and foreign relations from our curricula at all academic levels. It's doubtful that most of your listeners will really have a clue as to what geography is all about. But let me just say this. As an academic subject, it has been given very serious consideration, and I might say very high priority in some countries that most Americans are not aware of. The possibilists became perhaps the most innovative modern thinking geographers in France, but it was not until really the 19th century that the Germans developed geography to a very sophisticated level in their geopolitical concepts, or geopolitics as they would refer to it. And they worked out several strategies, and practically all of their military generals were also trained in geography. Well, this continued on into the very beginnings of the so-called former Soviet Union. In fact, even today, Moscow State University, or the University of Moscow, as it's sometimes also just called, has on its campus a towering structure. And at the upper levels of this towering structure is housed the Department of Geography, because it is such a prestigious academic subject within the Soviet Union. And unbeknownst to most Americans, geography is a fairly difficult subject. In fact, about two-thirds of those who would apply, let's say, to major in geography at the freshman level are generally weeded out by the time they reach the junior level. And those who do make it to the senior level, it is still a very challenging topic.
Well, this is really because it has more to do with just the boundaries of a nation. It has to do with the culture, the political structure, and the geopolitics, the history. All of these things would play a part. Would that be an accurate appraisal?
Yes, it would, especially in terms of external and external affairs of that nation.
All right, and so certainly the people who are interested in, and certainly in understanding the politics, how the country works and how it interrelates with other countries would be very deeply involved with the geography. Not simply, the lakes and the rivers, but this is an all-encompassing philosophy. We'll be back in just a moment with John Spring. Well, John, go ahead and explore the ideas a little further.
Well, the reason I want to take this one step further, if I may, Dr. Stan, is that those who do make it through the 4 or 5 year program at the University of Moscow become recipients of graduate scholarships, and those who do exceedingly well at the graduate level generally end up in very high key positions of the government, including becoming the key advisors to the president or the leader of Russia or the former Soviet Union, whatever the case might be. It doesn't really make much difference. The geographers basically do most of the planning. They work out the strategy. And so if you have a fairly good understanding of geography as I do, it's not too difficult to more or less at least guesstimate what the Soviets or the Russians or their allies are going to attempt to do sometime in the not-too-distant future.
All right, fine. Well, can you guesstimate what's going to happen then?
Well, unfortunately, the world's a little bit more complex in that it is not the Soviet Union or Communist China or any of their Marxist-Leninist allies who, within their political boundaries, are able to control policy of the world. As you pointed out so well in your book, The Brotherhood of Darkness, there is a group in Manhattan or New York City which basically have influence on many of the officials within these Marxist-Leninist nations, as well as other nations of the world. And so, being just a geographer by its title does not necessarily generate all of the answers one would like. However, having had an opportunity to correspond with people from all over the world since I was an adolescent, I've had an opportunity to basically exchange ideas and develop additional experiences which, besides my academic training in geography, have given me an ability to have and develop a fairly good understanding as to what will transpire. In fact, it was during the Reagan administration that former...
We'll let off right there. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is John Spring. And he's just talking about geography and about his experience in geography. And he was talking about his experiences during the Reagan administration. Go ahead, John.
Well, during the Reagan administration, because of my fairly impressive track record, going back to the early 60s, Senator Barry Goldwater at the time nominated me for a position as a junior deputy director with the National Security Council. Of course, I was never confirmed for such a position because, as you well know, most of such positions generally go to members of the Council of Foreign Relations or their trilateralist brothers or skull and bones or cap and gown associates, and so those of us on the outside never actually acquire such positions of prestige. And unfortunately, there's many things that people need to understand about the current nominee for Secretary of Defense. He has a rather interesting background. But
you're talking now about Robert Gates.
I'm talking now about Robert Gates. If I could very quickly go over his career highlights.
All right, fine. I think it's very important that people understand who this man is that asked to replace a Donald Rumsfeld. If anybody thinks anything different is going to happen there, they're in for a big disappointment. But go ahead. Who is Robert Gates, and why do you think he was picked to become the new Secretary of Defense?
Well, I think after I rattle off a few dates and titles and appointments, you'll sort of get a clue. From 1990 I'm sorry, from 1966 to 1974, he was an intelligence analyst with the CIA. From 1974 to 1979, he went to the National Security Council staff, but in 1979, he returned to the CIA.
And of course, but he was related to Zygmunt Brzezinski. He was working with him during some of that time, wasn't he?
Oh, absolutely.
And I think that's what's so key. Zygmunt Brzezinski is probably one of the two major architects of everything going on today. Now, they are certainly not at the top of this pyramid of control, but Zygmunt Brzezinski and Henry Kissinger are pretty close to the top of control. And Zygmunt Brzezinski was the head of the National Security Council, really controlled Jimmy Carter during the Carter administration from 1977 to 1980. Go ahead.
Yes. So I'm glad you brought that out. And then from 1982 till 1986, he was a deputy director for intelligence. And then in 1986 to 1989, he was a deputy director of Central Intelligence. So that means that he was second or third or fourth in command of the CIA at that time. And I'd like to come back to that historical time in a few moments, but from 1989 to 1991, he was Deputy National Security Advisor. So here he goes off to the National Security Council again for a while, and then in 1991 to 1993, he was the director of the CIA. Another very crucial time in our American history. And then, almost humorously, from 1999 to 2001, he was the interim dean of the George Bush School of Government and Public Service at Texas A&M. And then from 2002 until currently 2006, he has been president of Texas A&M University. Now, there are so many clues here that would cause me to have great concern about the credentials of Robert Gates.
Well, of course, he's a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. He's part of the ruling elite of our country, and he plays musical chairs. He goes from one key position to another key position, from the CIA into government, from the government into academia, and now coming in as the new Secretary of Defense. But he's part of this old boys club, the people who really run America, that most people have very little knowledge of.
Yes. Well, one thing I have a little bit of knowledge of is Afghanistan. As you know, Dr. Stan, Afghanistan was invaded by the former Soviet Union, or the Russians, back in 1979, when Brzezinski was still in control of the National Security Council.
December 1979, right? And, of course, basically that came about because we had, Brzezinski had been actually funding, through the CIA, the Mujahideen, who were opposing the Soviet puppet government, and threatened to overthrow the Soviet puppet government. And he did this intentionally to get the Soviets to intervene. And then once the Soviets sent their troops to Afghanistan to support their puppet government, now we had the excuse for the Afghan War, and then, of course, to create this whole Islamic terrorist movement, which grew out of the Afghan War. And the fact we were actually passing out copies of the Quran and encouraging these Islamic warriors in this radical form of Islam, which had been latent and not active for hundreds of years.
Yes, but from 1982 until 1986, when he served as deputy director for intelligence, that was a war of struggle, the Afghan War, and it really took quite a while before the United States provided any real significant aid to the Afghan freedom fighters or the Mujahideen. They were being beaten very badly by the Soviets with their Hind helicopter gunships, and it was not until later that some weapons were deployed that turned the tide of that war, which were mainly the Stinger surface air missiles.
But I know some of my friends that were actually training the Afghan warriors. They brought them over to Nevada, and they were actually training them right here in the United States. These are the Mujahideen, who eventually became Al-Qaeda. So much of their knowledge about the use of explosives and terror tactics came from our own Central Intelligence Agency and Green Berets. And
yes,
of course, they were getting money from Saudi Arabia. They were getting money from Pakistan, because you can't fight a war without money. It was certainly, you're right, the Stinger missiles, surface-to-air missiles, began bringing down the helicopters, and that was really more or less what defeated the Soviets, wasn't it?
Yes. The attrition rate of losing about 1.5 aircraft per day meant that eventually the Soviets and the Russians could no longer afford to give air I don't want to say air power, but
air cover
to their ground troops. And without the air cover, the ground troops eventually were removed from Afghanistan. But what I find most interesting is during the period between 1991 and 1993, when he was when he was director of the CIA, because that was the time period, Dr. Stan, in which the Pakistani ISI, which is their equivalent of CIA, sent in students from their madrasas, both in Pakistan and India, and sent them into Afghanistan to act as leaders and policemen to more or less control that nation. Well, this is a time when Afghanistan began to deteriorate, when it should have been showing some signs of prosperity, or at least having the desire to become more prosperous and free. But it became very oppressed, and the Taliban, of course, some of whom may have been former Mujahideen, but in reality, most of these Taliban, which of course means students, were brought in out of the country from various surrounding nations.
Now, there weren't a lot of them, the Pakistani students trained in madras schools.
Yes.
And so really, the Taliban was an outgrowth of Afghanistan, and Afghanistan's ISI intelligence was being largely funded by our CIA. So
exactly,
we were actually instrumental in creating this whole Taliban movement, which was a return to fundamentalist Islam. But we never let the American people know that today.
Right. And this is why I would be very reluctant, if I were a senator, to approve the nomination of Robert Gates, because in addition to getting more of the same, which Rockefeller, I'm sorry, that was a Freudian slip, which Donald Rumsfeld has given us over in Iraq, I think we're going to find that there's going to be more maddening skirmishes into neighboring Syria and Iran by having a person with this type of background and connections. So I don't think it's going to be very healthy for the American people to have a Robert Gates in such a key and high position at the Pentagon. But this is largely in the hands of the members of the U.S. Senate. So I would, and I know that the politics in Washington are such that the president will certainly want to gain his approval before, in this case, Robert Gates' approval, before the Christmas vacation this winter. So they're going to attempt to get him approved within the next few weeks, if that's possible, just after Thanksgiving. So I would urge everyone to write to their senators or call them at their offices tomorrow and urge them to have the senators really scrutinize the credentials of Robert Gates, because we cannot afford any more of these types of wars, which are killing so many of our fine young men and women, not just in Iraq and Afghanistan, but so many other parts of the world.
And of course, Afghanistan was a CIA war, and now the CIA will be in charge of the Defense Department.
Yes.
All right, go ahead, John.
So, and of course, the CIA and the Defense Department have changed so much. According to intelligence information that I've received within the last year from the United Kingdom, it appears that many of our so-called CIA agents have loyalties to other political entities throughout the world rather than serving the American people. And as you know, a good intelligence agent of any intelligence agency has basically two roles. One is, of course, to acquire information, and secondly, if it's ever possible, to help change a policy which is favorable to the nation that they are basically working for. And unfortunately, many of the intelligence agents are not working for the United States of America or the American people. And this transfers over into the Defense Department as well at the Pentagon, because it's very doubtful that we're going to have many people of the caliber of General MacArthur or General George Patton, because they are looking in their screening to find people who have faults or vices which basically they can use to control and blackmail and control military leaders in the future. So this is another concern that we must have if we are going to keep our freedom here in the United States, which is eroding away at a fairly rapid rate.
And I think what you're really saying is what they really are doing is promoting men into the general ranks, many of whom are simply yes men who will go along and compromise anything just to maintain the position of power. A perfect example of that was General Colin Powell, who lied, you know, when he was Secretary of State, you know, as far as the weapons of mass destruction, who actually, if you go into his whole background, you know, he lied about the depleted uranium in the first Gulf War. He lied about the Gulf War illness. He was always a good soldier. When he was told a lie, he lied. And we need men of integrity who will not compromise their principle. Men like former certainly Admiral Thomas Moore, who passed away recently.
Yes.
When he was ordered to lie and went before a trial, and that is the Operation Tailwind trial, that's another story, but he could not lie because he was an honest man. I wish we had more of those in the military today.
So do I. But until the American people, that's all of us, wake up and realize what is going on in Washington and throughout the world, we're going to continue to lose more of our freedoms, and more of these yes men will be placed into key and high positions, which will jeopardize the lives of so many young men and women, especially those who are deployed overseas.
But if anything bothers me more than that, John, is the prospect of these men who will do exactly what they're told rather than do what's right. And they now have the military power. And the president has the authorization under this new law, the John Warner Defense Appropriations Act, to use the U.S. military against American citizens. I hate to think what will happen when we have generals, American generals, who have no concern for the sovereignty of our nation or the Constitution, using the American military against the American people. I think that's a frightening thing.
Yeah.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is John Spring. And go right ahead, John. Pick the story up.
Well, I'll be glad to share with your listeners some of my thoughts and concerns about various realms of the world, including the Middle East and East Asia, and even North America, for that matter. But my primary concern is until the American people understand that when we find out information about a person such as Robert Gates and how his track record and career coincides with some very tragic events in terms of our foreign and military policies, I don't think spending my whole time divulging some things of interest that are happening throughout the world are going to be enough, because we need to understand that unless we wake up and are willing to take a little bit of time to either write a letter or perhaps even better yet, call our senators that represent our states, and also in some cases the senators of other states as well, because this is a very serious situation. Now, one thing that I found a little bit encouraging was that some of the outstanding senators, if there is such a person, in fact, I have reservations about all 100 of the U.S. senators, because all of them voted for the national ID card, but a few of them did mention that in previous votes they voted against Robert Gates when he was up to be nominated for other positions in the past. So hopefully, as disappointing as it might be for some people that the Democrats will soon control the U.S. Senate after shortly after Christmas in late January, then perhaps some things can be done. But in this particular situation, since the majority of U.S. senators are currently still Republicans, unless people take the initiative and write to their U.S. senators, in all probability he will be approved for his nomination without any resistance whatsoever.
Of course, I think probably more effective would be to call their office to fax or to email. I'm not sure whether even a lot of them don't like to open their letters for fear they're going to get another anthrax-laden letter, especially if you're a Democrat. Isn't it interesting that those wicked people, I suppose was Osama bin Laden, who sent out those anthrax letters, sent them all to Democrats. Isn't that interesting?
That is strange. He must have some type of a political bias, and
I'm sure Osama bin Laden doesn't like the Democrats. That's why we need to keep the Republicans in power, or something like that.
Well,
but of course, we really don't know who sent out those anthrax-laden letters, but we do know who knew about it ahead of time, and of course, Dick Cheney and the whole White House staff started on Cipro on the evening of September 11th, right after the 911 attack. I think the president did as well. So they obviously knew, or suspected, the anthrax attack was coming, but they didn't bother to tell the rest of us.
Yes.
Maybe they could probably help the FBI to figure out who sent out those letters to all those Democratic senators.
Yes. Yes, that would be nice if that did occur. But in all probability, that will never happen.
Well, let me just put our telephone number out. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or 464-8295. If you're out there in the listening audience, you have a question for John about the things we've talked about or another issue, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And, John, do you have a website or anything you'd like to get out to mention here?
Well, I do have a website which has not been currently maintained. However, the information at that website would be of interest to every listener. And that particular website is worldstrategy.netfirms. That's one word, N-E-T-F-I-R-M-S. Make sure you have the S at the end. .com. And I think they will be interested in the material they find there. Now, if anyone wants to email me, please email me at JWS, which are my initials, johnnycosta.com. That's spelled johnnycosta.com.
Give that one more time. JWS at
johnnycosta.com.
All right, fine. We're going to be back in just a moment. We'll welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is John Spring. And so, John, you go ahead and pick up the story.
Well, I thought I might just mention a few things about the current situation in Afghanistan. As I've mentioned to you before, Dr. Stan, for approximately 26 years now, I've known and been in contact with some high officials who have either held positions in Afghanistan or currently are in touch with people that hold very key and significant positions, including the king who serves his nation basically as a leader who is recognized by the majority of the people, but who does not currently hold any power, but he's very highly respected today, much more so than the current president, Hamid Karzai, who was more or less put into office by powers that be in Washington. As you know, Hamid Karzai used to work for UNICAL, possibly also for the CIA, and the George W. Bush administration placed him in power. But it's sort of ironic how he came to power, because we utilized the armed forces of some of the neighboring Soviet forces in bringing that about, as well as using some of the leaders who fought with the communists during the Afghan War, such as Dostum, for example. And on the other hand, as soon as Condoleezza Rice became National Security Advisor, she wanted to demonize or vilify Ismail Khan, who served as governor in the Herat province in western Afghanistan.
Well, you know what I think was really so interesting is we fought a 9-year war in Afghanistan, funding the Mujahideen to drive the Soviets out. And, of course, we drove most of them out. There was just a few of them in the northern area. They were known as the Northern Alliance. Then, of course, when we wanted to get rid of the Taliban, we financed the communists, the pro-communist Northern Alliance, and utilized them, along with the special forces teams we sent in, to kill the Taliban. So then, of course, we allowed the Northern Alliance, which was communist, to come back into a position of power and actually to help support the new government under Karzai that we put in. So you have to ask yourself, are we really anti-communist? Or as much of this just plain old showbiz? We'll be right back. Well, our guest this evening is John Spring, and certainly we're talking about Afghanistan. And if you're out there in the listening audience, you have a question or comment on the things we're talking about or something else you'd like to ask John, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Go right ahead, John.
Well, ironically, the Afghan people welcomed the American forces and our allies from other European nations representing the coalition forces in Afghanistan. And they've been very patient with us for several years now. But unfortunately, the American people are unaware of the fact that there has been really no serious attempt whatsoever to improve upon or enhance their existing infrastructure, such things as irrigation projects, which are so badly needed, for example, in the Helmand Valley. And this is an area where they could grow enough crops to produce the food for at least 40% of Afghan's population just in one area alone. But unfortunately, nothing has been rebuilt, and only dry farming can be practiced there. And so guess what their main crop is in that area?
Well, of course, the thing is that the Taliban had pretty well done away with the opium trade. And as soon as we got in, why, we got the opium trade going again. And most of the Americans know we're involved in war on drugs, and they just find it so difficult to understand why it is that, you know, when the Taliban were in power, why they did away with the drugs primarily. And now that the Americans are in power, why, the drugs are blooming, and we just can't seem to figure out how to stop all those poppies. I mean, we don't want to use our helicopters because they might get shot down. You know, we don't want to spray because, my goodness, we'd be unpopular with the local warlords. And so we are allowing Afghanistan to be the largest producer of opium when it's directly under our control. We could end it tomorrow, and we have no intention of doing it anymore. That we really have a war on drugs. Our war on drugs is as phony as a $3 bill. But we can't let the American people know that. And now that we control it, why, the opium fields are blooming again. So go ahead, John.
Yes. Well, this is one reason why I'm very concerned about the appointment of Robert Gates as our next Secretary of Defense, because from 1991 to 1983, when he was Director of CIA, his counterparts in Afghanistan and in Pakistan, the ISI, were sending so-called businessmen or agents into Afghanistan and encouraging and rewarding farmers to plant the opium poppy as a crop, which, of course, can be derived for heroin. And for some reason, the American people have not caught on to this connection, that our own CIA has had a very significant involvement in the production of opium and heroin in Afghanistan, and its trade and its distribution to Europe and even the United States.
But of course, this is exactly what happened in Asia when we were involved in the war in Vietnam. In fact, one reason we were there was, of course, to keep the opium lines open. And of course, we're carrying a book now. We actually have it in stock, used copies, but they're excellent quality. It's called "Kiss the Boys Goodbye" by Monica Jensen Stevenson. Talks about Vietnam, talks about the men we abandoned there, and talks about the CIA involvement in the opium trade. In fact, this book was so clear-cut and straightforward and documented, the CIA's involvement that in the opium trade, that the publisher was somebody put pressure on them, and they withdrew all of the books so that they could not be sold. And then, of course, later Monica got the copyright back, moved to Canada, and the book was published up there. Somebody bought the publisher there and shredded 5,000 paperback copies of the book. We now have the book. And you can't understand what's going on in Afghanistan and the drugs there unless you understand another war called Vietnam. And
yeah,
the CIA, which ran that war and their involvement in drugs, and the CIA is largely running the war in Afghanistan and in Iraq today. Until people understand that, and now we're putting somebody from the CIA in charge of the Defense Department, I think every American should be concerned.
Yes, they should. Even when the French were at Dien Bien Phu, the harvesting of the opium poppy at Plains of Jars, or the Plain of Jars in Laos, not too far away, caused so much smoke that the foreign press thought that this was the fall of the Fort Dien Bien Phu. I might mention, since we are talking about Vietnam briefly, that there are several Americans of Vietnamese ancestry who have been currently held in prison in Vietnam for more than 1 year without a trial. They allegedly are being accused of being terrorists, and in all probability they will never won't be released, at least for another decade, if they're ever released at all. And yet, ironically, we find that President George W. Bush and his Secretary of State, Dr. Condoleezza Rice, are planning a trip to Vietnam within the very near future. I think it might be a good gesture on the part of every listener to write a letter to the White House or to the Department of State and demand that these Americans of Vietnamese ancestry who are imprisoned on trumped-up charges be released immediately.
Well, of course, the thing is, I think we ought to demand the release of the men we abandoned that Henry Kissinger abandoned back in 1974. And that's what the subject of the book, Kiss the Boys Goodbye, is all about, the men we abandoned. And why is it that John McCain and John Kerry were so intent upon most favored nation treaty status for Vietnam, that has never returned our men. And the fact that this has been totally suppressed from the American people is so tragic. I wonder how they feel about a country that's betrayed them. Well, I hope everybody will want to get the book, The Men We Left Behind, because believe me, the powers that be did everything to suppress the book. We now have, I think, 20 or 30 hardbound copies of that book, and you can get it along with a four-tape set on The Men We Left Behind. The book is called Kiss the Boys Goodbye, and the story of the men we abandoned. Okay, let's go to Mike, who's calling here. Hi, Mike, did you have a question for our guest?
Yeah, I have a question. Forgive me if I missed anything that you already talked about regarding Rumsfeld.
Yes.
Is there anything in the works about him being dragged before the World Court for war crimes? Particularly torture?
In all probability, he will never be tried for any war crimes, just as other members of the Bush administration in the Department of Defense, State, or in the White House itself, will, including Dick Cheney's assistants, will never face any trials for alleged war crimes.
I think it's very interesting, though, Mike, that the over in Germany, where they've actually pressed charges, and I believe that they're trying to draw up warrants for Donald Rumsfeld's arrest. Now, there's no way that they were going to extradite Donald Rumsfeld to Germany to stand a trial for crimes against humanity, but he is actually being charged in Germany under international statute. So
okay,
it's very interesting to see how that plays out.
Yeah, that's what I was hearing about.
But, Mike, there's something else that we might consider. And Dr. Stan's very much aware of this, too. When Donald Rumsfeld represented a pharmaceutical firm during the 1980s, he promoted the sale of anthrax, and with his clout and influence, he was able to get the aspartame approved by the U.S. government, and even at that time, the beverage industry was opposed to using aspartame under such trade names as Equal
NutraSweet is
or, or NutraSweet in their soda pop drinks. But eventually, Rumsfeld got FDA approval for that. And then it's been alleged that when he was with a chemical firm, that he took a trip to Iraq and provided Saddam Hussein with chemical reagents, which were used, of course, the chemical gases to kill innocent Kurds and Iranians and other Iraqis.
And of course, the thing is that Robert Gates has been incriminated in that as well, in the funding of Saddam Hussein, the wicked Saddam Hussein, who killed 100,000 Kurds and I don't know how many hundreds of thousands of Iranians. And Robert Gates was intimately involved with that, as well as Donald Rumsfeld. So birds of a feather sort of stick together.
Well, it's kind of surprising in light of that that he would get the appointment.
Well, he doesn't have the appointment yet, and hopefully there'll be enough Americans who write to their senators and say, look into Robert Gates' involvement with Saddam Hussein and the funding and financing of Saddam Hussein, of the wicked Saddam Hussein. Maybe if there are enough people who do what we're talking about tonight, maybe Mr. Gates could just simply fade away into the woodwork and no longer be there to betray our nation and the people of Iraq and the people of the world.
Maybe. Well, they know now, don't they?
Well, let's hope they do anyway. Anything else, Mike?
That's all. Thanks.
God bless. And again, our number 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Go right ahead, John.
Well, Mike brought up a very good point, and I think we need to understand that we still do in this constitutional republic have a little bit of say if we will only use it. But unfortunately, most Americans are complacent to watch Monday Night Football or some interesting, entertaining TV program about dancing or some scandalous soap opera, and they're not at all concerned about the well-being of our nation, which is hanging by a very thin thread right now. as you mentioned on your previous hour, by the year 2010, we're scheduled to merge with Canada and Mexico, losing our sovereignty, and a supranational nation will be formed with a supranational government, which has its loyalty only to the United Nations charter, basically, throwing our constitutional rights out the window. And so we need to be concerned about this, just like the national ID card, which, if it goes on schedule, will be issued to all of us by the year 2008, and for all practical purposes, we will be under house arrest at that time. So it's so important that the American people wake up. And
well, because that's why talk radio is so important, and that's why I hope you can get back on in the Los Angeles area, John, because I think the more voices we have out there, the more chances that people will hear the truth and begin to understand that freedom is not free and that tyranny like hell is not easily conquered. Tyranny like hell is not easily conquered. That's actually a phrase that came from Thomas Paine.
Yes.
But, of course, it is true today as it was when he said it.
Absolutely.
As he said, you know, all societies are good, but government, even at its best, is a necessary evil, and at its worst is intolerable. And, ladies and gentlemen, we're approaching that time when government is intolerable. They've passed all sorts of new legislation since 9-1-1. The Patriot Act, the Office of Homeland Security Act, the Model State Emergency Health Powers Act, and then, of course, just last month, the Military Commissions Act, which, of course, suspended habeas corpus and removed the right of the courts to intervene in defense of someone who is accused of being a military combatant, and actually anyone who criticizes the government could fall into that category. And then, of course, the John Warner National Defense Authorization Act, a frightening piece of legislation that allows the federal government, the president, to actually declare a martial law. And even this is what Patrick Leahy had said, the Democratic senator. Patrick Leahy said this encourages the president to establish martial law in America by giving him a right to mobilize National Guard troops without the permission of the state governor, and to use them against Americans in the case of a disease outbreak, in the case of an attack of some sort, or certainly in the case of unrest, civil unrest. So, and then going along with the fact that they've given Halliburton $385 million to build detention camps, you wonder what they really have in mind. Is it really concerned about Osama bin Laden, who's probably been dead for a couple of years? Or do they have something else in mind for Americans? Notice we never see any recent pictures of bin Laden. I would suggest that our listeners who are curious go up on the Internet and Google in bin Laden is dead. And you'll find tens of thousands of references to that. It's well known throughout the rest of the world. They just haven't told the American people yet, because we have to have a boogeyman. And do you know a better boogeyman than Osama bin Laden? Go ahead, John.
No, I don't know a better boogeyman. And we're very anxious now to have Saddam Hussein hanged for his alleged crimes against his people. But I think the American people need to wake up very soon that things are going to be happening here in the United States which are going to take away our rights to hold on to our property, to hold on to our thoughts, basically, to express concerns which are not selfish but altruistic. And to be quite honest, I think we may have less than 2 years of opportunity left to get out the information to as many people as possible. We don't have to get this out to millions of people, but if we can get this information out to at least a few thousand dedicated American men and women, we can turn this around and regain our freedoms that we should have here in a constitutional Republic.
Amen to that. Well, we've got Carell calling from Fort Thomas, Kentucky. Hi, Carell.
Well, I sent you a DVD. I don't know if you've gotten it yet. It's Terry Hayfield from the in the Boat Frog Convention up here, 2000.
I did get something. I haven't had a chance to
look at it. You probably haven't gotten it yet.
No.
But is this John Spring?
John Spring, yes.
Yes, ma'am.
John Spring. Well, you mentioned that this Robert Gates is at Texas A&M.
He was a huge place.
Yes.
What? He lives down there.
Currently, he's planning to reside in Washington as Secretary of Defense.
Unless, of course, you can write enough letters and convince the senators that he's not fit to serve as Defense Secretary. And I think that we really need to have everybody understanding where Mr. Robert Gates is coming from. He likes to play musical chairs. He's simply one of the elite who rules our country, and he was instrumental in the financing of the wicked Saddam Hussein back in the 1980s.
And Barry Goldwater tried to get John Spring to serve in that capacity, but he wasn't.
Different capacity. Hold on.
Yeah.
Okay, go right ahead. Did you have something else to say, Carol?
Barry
Goldwater had nominated John, but he wasn't really seriously considered because he's not part of the establishment.
No. Well, I don't know how to get on the internet.
You can simply send a fax. You can put a call into the local office and just let them know you're very concerned.
And
get everybody
else to both
know
my
it.
Senators.
What's that?
To both my senators.
Right.
Who are no good, Nick.
Right. But that's all right. At least let them know that you know they're no good.
Yeah. Right.
Okay.
I would like to have some background on John Spring, if he would.
Oh, he actually did that at the very beginning of the program, but he's a professional geographer, and of course he's a
certain person all
throughout the world. And maybe you'd like it to drop him a note. What's your address, or how could people...
Can I telephone John?
Well, if you would send me a note at Post Office Box 18946, Anaheim, spelled A-N-A-H-E-I-M, California, 92817...
92847?
No, 92817.
17.
Okay,
I'll try to do that. I'm pretty...
All right, Carol. John's a good friend. He's been... we've known him for...
But I have all those books you're talking about, Dr. Stan.
Good.
I've been reading those for years all kinds of stuff on fluoridation.
Well, Carol, your job is to get other people back there. You obviously know what's going on. You need to get
into
the program.
Well, I do.
Yes.
So you encourage them to listen and tell them you heard this crazy guy on shortwave or on the internet. Get them listening and then let them start. They usually start out thinking we're crazy. Before long, they're afraid we're not. So God bless you, we're out of time.
Right.
Thanks very much for calling and thanks for listening.
Terrell, I'm looking forward to receiving a letter from you.
All right. And it's John Spring.
John Spring.
Like
right.
The season. Yes.
PO Box 18946.
Yes.
Anaheim, California. 92817. Gonna write it tonight.
Good night, Carol.
Okay, God bless.
Bye bye.
Thanks, John.
And I want to thank you so very much, John, for being with us. It's always a pleasure having you here. And I have a parting thought for about 30 seconds.
I just urge all Americans to consider the importance of what we were talking tonight about, including the nomination of Robert Gates for Secretary of Defense. I urge each and every one of you to contact your senators and the senators of other states, because whoever is in charge of the Pentagon basically will call the shots in terms of who in our military will have to serve overseas and how many young men and women will be armed with.
This is Dr. Stan, and I certainly hope that many of you out there will give serious consideration to getting some of the items we carry that will help you understand what's really going on. We carry the DVD, Terror Stone by Alex Jones. We think it's excellent. We're carrying the DVD 911, Press for the Truth. It's the story of the Jersey girls, the four widows who lost their husbands and when the Twin Towers went down. Very professionally done. Of course, we have a Dave's video. It's entitled In Plain Sight. And then, of course, we carry a DVD or video put up by our good friend David Wagner entitled 911, The Day That Changed America Forever. It's got a lot of fascinating footage in it that you aren't going to be seeing elsewhere. John did a great job with that. But in the final analysis, those buildings were brought down as a controlled demolition. And all you need to do is go up on Google and Google in building number 7 videos, and you can watch there on a number of sites. Those building comes down, and of course, a controlled demolition. The way they keep the building from collapsing outward is they collapse the center of the building first. Watch as the center of building 7 at 5 o'clock in the evening begins to collapse down, and then the base of the building simply explodes and the building falls. It was a controlled demolition. They lied about that. They lied about everything. And then, of course, you'll certainly want to be getting our latest newsletters, our August, September newsletter. Our October newsletter is done, will be available very, very shortly. We hope you'll want to get my three pamphlets on Foreknowledge 911, the book The Terror Timeline. If you want to know where this whole radical Islamic movement came from, it's an excellent book, The Devil's... I believe it's The Devil's Deals, Robert Dreyfus. Anyway, it's the book by Robert Dreyfus, and The Devil's Game is the title of the book, The Devil's Game. And then, of course, we hope that you'll get my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. If you're interested, of course, in helping Radio Liberty, our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Quite frankly, we do need people to support us as we reach out across America on almost 60 outlets every single week. We're reaching people all across America, all across the world. So if you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters, my telephone number 1-800-544-8927. Remember, we do carry the Berkey products. And if you do get them to us, why, there's either a video or a four-tape set that we produce that's available to you. We are carrying now of the book we mentioned, Kiss the Boys Goodbye, written by Monica Jensen Stevenson, a book that has been actively suppressed. And we have, these are used books. They have, many of them are in excellent condition, though. They have their dust covers on them, and you can get them at the original price. And, of course, we hope that you'll want to get, with Kiss the Boys Goodbye, four-tape set, and you can get that as the special, the Kiss the Boys Goodbye special, and it's a four-tape set on The Men We Left Behind. Now, we're also carrying Spite House. That's available in paperback, and, of course, the tape set that goes with that is One Man Returned. So it's Kiss the Boys Goodbye and The Men We Left Behind tape set, or Spite House and One Man Returned. We hope you'll get this information. It has been actively suppressed for many years. You can't understand Iraq or anything going on today unless you understand what happened in Vietnam. So this is the time we ask you to pray for America, to pray for revival, to pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. Our number 1-800-544-8927.
You're tuned to the Global Star Radio Network. Thanks for listening. Yeah.
Good afternoon, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Wherever you're situated on this great, big, beautiful blue globe floating through the void of Yah's creation, it is Tuesday, the 14th of November, 2006. And the more people that are tuning into the Power Hour, we're getting so many more new emails. We're getting folks contacting us from all over the world saying, oh my gosh, I had no idea. And they are now recognizing the very simple, undeniable fact that we as a species are at the crossroad. And they're all asking that most important question, where, oh where, is the line in the